Welcome back to Born to Know, where curiosity leads and consciousness follows. Today's conversation invites us into a rarely explored dimension of beauty with facial cosmetic surgeon Dr. Cameron Chestnut. This episode goes far beyond procedures and aesthetics. Together, we explore how aging, hormones, posture, even stress, all reflect through the face. But more importantly, we explore beauty as an invitation, not to fix ourselves, but to meet ourselves. Dr. Chestnut brings a deeply human perspective to cosmetic rejuvenation, one rooted in awareness, nuance, and compassion. From the filtered ideals shaping teenage minds to the emotional energy we carry in our skin, this is a conversation about understanding our beauty without judgment. And just when you think it's all skin deep, we get into the real heat. How Botox can change and form relationships, teenage transformations, and what no one's saying about the future of our faces. Dr. Chestnut, thank you so much for joining me today. I am so pleased to have you. It's an honor.
Thank you. I'm honored to be here. Thank you for having me.
There are so many directions that I want to take this conversation in. I found your work because I had started coming into contact with rejuvenation, different forms of facial transformation, you know, how the algorithm is online. I also had friends who were getting, just researching different avenues of longevity and all kinds of things. And so a friend of mine who is a specialist with buccal inner mouth massage, she's an esthetician, she sent me your work and I started seeing things on social media, really extreme things. And then I was looking at your approach and I was like, wow, he's really coming at this from a holistic perspective. How you prepare your patients for their work, how you help them with the recovery. And then I was seeing this, stark contrast, people going overseas, for example, and coming back completely transformed. And a lot of ethical issues actually came up for me as I was reflecting on this. And so I was so excited to talk to you and I'll get a little bit more into that, but I would just first love to hear what inspired you to come into this work. I mean, surgery is a very, very specific type of path, and then to approach it from the way that you do, what was your inspiration?
Yeah, well, I think if you really go back into medicine, getting into medicine in the first place, the idea of being a healer and what that looks like, if that's sort of your approach, if we're really lucky in that process, we get to find some path that aligns with our values, our inherent personality of who we are, which I would side note means you have to know what your values are, which is hard for some people to sit with and define sometimes. But for me, that led me towards this three-dimensional spatial type of procedures with my hands. And what I do starts with a lot of reconstructive surgery, especially when we're talking about the face. And there's a lot of overlap with reconstructive surgery and cosmetic surgery and how those things fit together. And so as I was progressing through that path, I saw in the cosmetic niche of this, in that world, that things were getting quite literally distorted. And I was curious about why that was happening, and I looked into it and I realized that there's some different mindsets in there, and I saw a way to do it better. And I know that sounds super cliche, but quite literally just a little bit of a mindset shift into a different way, and we get into some areas that are more rejuvenative than transformative. And that's kind of what you're describing with the people that are going overseas and they come back a different person, extreme, looking different. Transformation is taking something that never existed and creating it. And that could be something as simple as like a different nose or breasts or something like that. Those are subtle transformations. My world is much more in rejuvenating, creating things that were the way they were before. And this is usually the aging process. An aging process can happen young. It can happen from metabolic stress. It can happen with a lot of different physiologic stresses too. But I'm usually taking things and putting them back where they came from before. If I could nutshell my life, it's putting a fat pad back where it used to be or something along those lines. And that creates creates a match in energy sometimes, or in personality, or when you look in the mirror. So a lot of times what you're feeling inside.
Yeah, it's really amazing what you say about the energy, because like I mentioned too, I'm in South Florida, I'm in Miami, I've been here for a long time now, and I see that there are like different camps maybe of individuals who will spend time really preparing, you know, doing everything they can in their lifestyle to support rejuvenation, longevity, anti-aging. And then there's the approach that's like, it's for me, like in my nervous system, it feels like pretty intense and severe, because it's like, I won't do anything to support the regeneration of tissue or, you know, reversing or metabolic age or dealing with, you know, oxidative stress. I won't do any of that. I'll just go in and get these really extreme things done and then just keep kind of piling it on, hoping for the best and not really knowing what's going to happen down the road. So it seems like with your approach and, you know, what I've seen, it's the whole picture. And I don't know, for me, for whatever reason, it just feels like that's an empowered approach, because the individual is taking that responsibility, the accountability, and collaborating with you to get results and to meet a goal that they have in mind and in heart. So what are some of the things, I mean, this is kind of like the, when I was talking to a few people about speaking with you, it was like the big thing was like, well, what are the things that we do every day so that we can support this process?
Right. Yeah. I mean, what you just mentioned is sort of gets into this idea of being reactive versus proactive. But to be more specific, I would say that proactivity is this regenerative aspect of things that we're talking about. You know, you mentioned even metabolic aging, which we can look at. We can see what your metabolic age is. We can see what your genetic age is. And you could be 53 or 54 years old or 45 years old and have a metabolic age of 41 and a genetic age that's much younger, but that doesn't always align perfectly with what we're looking like on the outside. And that's the energy. That's like a cognitive dissonance. It creates a mismatch, right? And so they are linked together. And the things that we can do every day, or that we should be doing every day, are really, when we get into the holistic part of things, these are metabolically focused, right? These are what's happening with your nutrition, your physiology, what's happening with your inflammation and oxidation standpoint. Those have significant effects on what's happening with our tissue. Not to mention the emotional side of things, which creates cortisol. When we get down to the science of it, we're talking about a stress hormone that undoubtedly changes and affects our aging curve, especially in areas like the face. Has effects on so many different types of tissue that are wildly important to how our facial aging happens. And so the things that we all know we should be doing really rubber meets the road when we can see what's happening on the outside. And that's linked to what's happening in the intima of your arteries and things like that. So there's a lot of that overlap. On the face, we just have this beautiful ability to have these little nudges that improve what's happening there. And at some point you can have a more significant, you know, reset to those types of things as well.
So when it comes to the energy, we're talking about the energy behind youthfulness, let's say anti-aging, the rejuvenation, like how much of that is required in this process, would you say, for a woman to address the psychological, psycho-emotional elements of this? You also mentioned a cognitive dissonance. So are there things to reconcile and to shift? Like, I come across women who maybe like chronologically are of an advanced age, and there is just a radiance and a youth to them that is like coming from somewhere, right? And I've encountered, you know, women who are in their late 20s, and you would say, okay, this is someone who is like a picture of youth and radiance, but there is like maybe a heaviness or something that doesn't actually exude that youthfulness and radiance. Like, what is this intangible thing I'm noticing everywhere?
Oh my goodness. This is my world, is trying to understand those things better and how identify them and work with them, right? So I have a long pre-process before I work with somebody, and long, you know, is arbitrary, but I'm really trying to understand the person in the relationship, because these relationships are wildly important to me. And it's like, you know, I want to really seek to understand. I kind of tell my patients, we're forever enmeshed once we work together, usually. And that's, I want that to be a good thing. Right. So And I'm thinking about that, and I'm trying to understand, and I want to be able to give them their magic wand as to what they would want to happen. But you're right. Sometimes it's very different than what you might expect, right? And then from that point forward, we have time where I'm trying to optimize them leading into their surgical procedure. Now, again, I'm trying to keep the surgical procedure as minor as I can, but in general, the more metabolically and physiologically optimized we are going into it, the better the procedure is going to go. We're going to have better process, better surgery, better outcomes, and better end results. But there is this part that I don't get to talk about as much. I'm often talking about the physiology and the metabolism, but there's this emotional part to it as well. And that emotional part, you want that to be optimized as well. You want the person to understand even their own internal drives and desires as to why they're doing it. And it's okay. These procedures are okay to do. It's you just want to have a very clear picture as to who you're doing it for, why you're doing it. And, you know, spoiler alert, the best answer that I can hear that really helps me understand is that I want to look how I feel inside. That is really often what it boils down to. And that's what you're talking about with that, you know, somebody who's more advanced age radiating this youth, but then maybe they feel when they walk into a room or when they look in the mirror that it's not what they're seeing. And they're not putting out the same thing that they're feeling like they're exuding. And, you know, there can be judgment around that. And there can be people who would say, you know, age gracefully and don't worry about it. But they're not understanding the cognitive dissonance or the mismatch that happens there. And it's real. And this gets into the sort of neuroanatomy of how we work, but we're hardwired as humans to recognize those changes. We have whole areas of our brain that go just into facial recognition and its identity and its beauty and its emotion and its communication. And all of that comes from what's happening in our face, specifically really around our eyes and our mouth predominantly.
Yeah. I mean, this is something that actually came up when a large part of the world, you know, was masked during these times we were in recently. And I remember being in the labor room with women and working with children in the postpartum phases. And there was a lot missing because children and women who were laboring were not able to see mouths. And so this is my world, for those of you listening who don't know, you know, being in the birth room with women who couldn't see the doctor's mouths or the nurses speaking, there was this almost edge that was created because we are animals, right, who need to feel safe and use the mouth and the eyes to identify the spectrum of safety or danger that we're on, you know, and also the trust that we're building with the people around us. So this is huge. And this was actually one of the questions that came in, was like with things like Botox, for example, or fillers, where it actually changes one's capacity to express easily, how does this or how can this like psychologically affect, relationships? Or do you see, you know, it's so subtle that we don't notice, but do you perceive that this actually can impact relationships?
Well, this is a wildly polarizing topic as it is. And so I just have to acknowledge that from the get-go. And when we look at evidence, there is certainly evidence to support this coming from different walks of research, whether it's psychology or cosmetics. We need facial expressions to bond and communicate most effectively, right? And so if you can't see somebody's mouth, but you can hear them talking, there's certainly tones and inflections you can get, but you're missing something from not being able to see. No question about it, right? So on one end, neuromodulators like Botox, Dysport, these products on the market, they by definition change the ability of a muscle in our face to contract. That's what they're doing on some level. They're neuromodulating the muscle, and they're reducing the expression that muscle can give. That doesn't mean they're taking it away. They're just, from a amplitude standpoint, they're reducing it. And sometimes they are taking it all the way away. We know that happens in the forehead, that, you know, quintessential frozen look, right? So that doesn't always happen, but it gets reduced. And so the amplitude can change. And so on some sense, yes, in the cosmetic world, many will argue that it's not enough to change things. You can still get all the inflections and tones and communication that you need. But we know on some level that there's at least an amplitude importance to this, and that is reduced. So, and I've said this, and I have caught heat for it and for all kinds of reasons. But one of the situations that I would just, and this is just a suggestion for me based off of, I'm clearly not a mom and I never have been, but I would just say, if you have a baby who doesn't understand language fully yet, and they're relying on your facial expression, kind of like you just mentioned when we have a mask on, is that's probably not the best time to get Botox, because those even reduced amplitudes could potentially change some interpretation of your communication. You can tell that I'm really dancing around this, because I also want to say, if you did get Botox, or you have had Botox, or you have Botox and you have a baby, you have not done any permanent damage. It's not some massive mistake that you've made. It's just a observational suggestion based off of some research that's real about a way to maybe optimize some of that communication better, because we make communication mistakes all the time. And it's not just in our facial expression. And so, yeah, that again, really polarizing topic, but definitely something that, you know, has pros and cons. You know, I'm not anti-Botox, to be honest, but I do see situations where I do see cons to it. It's not all upside.
Yeah. Well, I think a really great resource that I'll just mention, if anyone wants to go a little deeper, that this isn't something you're pulling out of a hat. I mean, there have been actual psychological experiments done. Dr. Edward Tronick's experiment called the still face experiment that he did over the course of many years shows us that. I mean, just the slightest inflections can really have an impact in the way that the baby is perceiving your state of being and reality. So of course it's not a judgment. It's just a fact. This is how, you know, human mammals form their relationships. And so, yeah, it might be something to consider, right? Just, you know, taking a break or waiting for that initial period of time where that mother baby dyad is very connected and strong, you know. Yeah. And apart from that, I'm so curious. I mean, I know this is information that could probably be sourced online, but I would love to hear what you think, because I know many women who I feel like are quite young to be like maybe concerned, because I'm perceiving that there's this like homogenized idea of beauty, maybe because of social media, you know, and like whoever's like leading the trend of what things could look like. And I could list a few influencers, perhaps, maybe like the Kardashians, because in Miami, it's like there's definitely just like echoes of them walking around everywhere, you know, and it's a look. It's a very kind of cookie cutter look, let's say. So I see young women who have their own authentic, unique beauty start to shift things in order to fit that mold. And so, you know, what happens long-term if a woman begins in her 20s or early 30s getting like fillers and doing the Botox and making some maybe subtle adjustments to look a certain way, like, I mean, neurologically, and if we're looking at toxicity, like what are the long-term effects of doing this and the frequency in which it's being done?
Right. And there's a lot in there, even from the neuroanatomic understandings of perceptions of beauty and how that goes. And there's been homogenization of that since their images became available. You know, this goes back into the 70s and things, right? So, but now we have a lot more images available. You're right. And it starts to snowball and it becomes, you know, more homogenized the more that we can see, right? So that is definitely happening. And it is driving younger interventions. It's driving younger anti-aging interventions, meaning that some people in their 30s, late 30s, early 40s, are now seeking out like gravitational types of like facelifting procedures. So there's that. And that is truly rejuvenative, but it's rejuvenating this much type of thing. And again, that's not wrong. That's actually one of the things that I kind of specialize in and do a lot of, because my whole approach is sort of this Pareto 80-20 principle of like, let's do as little as we can and make that happen without going full blown on some big procedure that you don't need, right? So I have little micro techniques to accomplish those things durably. The problem is you're walking into a minefield of misinformation. I'll just say that. And that maybe isn't the exact right term to put it, but it's really hard to navigate or separate the pearls from the poo of all the things that are out there a little bit, right? And this is what happens with a homogenized image, a really beautiful 20-something-year-old, and altering, which is at this point transform. If you're 20-something and you're getting filler, you are probably transforming, not rejuvenating at that point. So back to that terminology, right? Say it's your lips or something like that. And that becomes unnatural, just in, especially when talking about a face, it becomes unnatural from where you were meant to be at 20-something years old, right? So the ideas behind it that perpetuate this is that you're supposed to look this way, which is a whole nother topic. But then in my area of expertise is, okay, now we're talking about this, let's say filler. You mentioned fillers. Let's this filler that you just put in your face, the misunderstandings or misconceptions about it really drive this behavior. One of those being this filler only lasts 6 to 12 months or 18 months or something like that. That is not true. We know that's not true. We can look under microscopes from tissue samples in areas where there's been filler. We can find it on MRI studies when we look at imaging. And then in my world, I find it surgically all the time. It's almost a comical situation where I work on inside of somebody's face and they say, well, I've never had filler. I haven't had filler for 13 years or whatever. And I find it. It's still there. It does not have this short lifespan where it goes away. It does move and migrate around the face. We know that that happens. Injectors, people who do this, yeah, they love to crucify this conversation. But it's interesting in that because they say it does not migrate. And it only lasts 6 months and this, that, and the other. But now we know that they're starting to realize this is happening. And we're talking about it. And we in the cosmetics world talking about, well, the migration is a good thing because it's homogenizing around to one specific area, which is not its intent when it's placed. And so now we're changing the end result a little bit because we're understanding, oh, it does migrate and it's not where you first put it. And you can imagine in the lips, if you're putting it to try to augment the pink portion of your lip called the vermilion lip, and it ends up all the way up at the base of your nose, that was unintended. I did a study with one of my fellows years back where we looked at that exact thing, how much filler that's placed in the lip migrates up to the base of the nose. And in 98% of people, it had migrated to the base of the nose within months, 6 months or and beyond. So it's inside of a muscle at that point. That's not what we want it to be doing. And then we get into this idea that it's easily dissolvable. It only lasts 6 months. It stays where it's put, which we know none of those are true. And if you don't like it, you can just put this enzyme on it and make it go away. That has a whole nother conversation behind it because the enzyme is not perfect. It does reduce it, but it doesn't get rid of it all. Again, in surgery, I see people who've been through rounds and rounds and rounds of dissolution, and I still find filler. And the enzyme itself, this is another hot, polarizing, controversial topic, but it can potentially have impacts on our facial structure and volume, specifically with this one little it's actually an extracellular matrix. It's called hyaluronic acid, which is what the fillers are made out of. But we have it in our face, and it supports the structure and hydration of our skin outside of our cells in our face. So we don't want to get rid of all of our own hyaluronic acid. If you're young, it can recover. But if you go too much, too hard, too frequently, we see changes in the face permanently from that enzyme. So that's not a great safety net or magic wand option either. And so there's just a lot of things like this that make it, it's every decision we make has a consequence, and getting filler at any point has more consequences than we think. That doesn't mean it's bad. Filler has a place, absolutely does. It's when we start talking about the distortions that come with it, distortions of our face, distortions of our perception, and ultimately distortions of ourself a little bit. Excuse me, those distortions of perception you mentioned a little bit. There's this idea of perception drift. When you start getting filler regularly in your whatever age, if you're getting it every 6 or 12 months along the way, what you're seeing in the mirror changes. What your baseline, your North Star changes because of what you see. And so you get your filler and it's a small change. And 6 months later, you get it again and it's another small change. And your norm of perception starts to drift down this road. But if you go back and take everything at once, and sometimes this happens with a friend or a family member, and they say, you don't look like yourself anymore. And you go back to the beginning, you're like, oh, that's true. It just happened over 10 small increments or something like that. That's really common.
Yeah, I mean, this happens psychologically in certain situations, right? I mean, this is, it's like the boiling frog, where it's like you just little by little, and then eventually, you know, the frog is boiled, right? And so that kind of leads me back to these extreme cases that, you know, maybe I'm just like so naive to this whole thing, but I was seeing these cases of women who, you know, like a rhinoplasty, changes in the eyes actually look different, like jaw and chin reconstruction, and all of it being done at once. And I see these before and afters, which are incredibly impressive, because I know it's not Photoshop. I know Photoshop well. And I'm like, wow, okay. And then it got me thinking, you know, this is really impressive. I don't know the psychological impacts. I don't know the kind of fallout that can happen psychologically and emotionally for this individual integrating back into daily life. This seems a little bit extreme. And then it led into the idea of adolescence and distortion, because as you might be aware, you know, girls now, if they have social media, you know, 10-year-olds, they're seeing women. Like, I saw a video recently where she was 12 years old and she was talking about her skincare routine and what she does every night to, you know, prevent aging. And I was like, oh, like when I was a kid in the early 90s, like I wouldn't have even ever thought, like, I think I used to maybe copy the things my mom did. Like, I'd put clay on my face or something and be like, oh, you know, she would take me to Beverly Hills and like they would put dry ice on my cheeks to like help me feel like I was part of her facial process or whatever. But like to ever think that like I needed to focus on anti-aging, I realized there's no gap anymore. There's no adolescence. It's like you go from 10 to 16, or you go from like 10 to 17, and now you're like this young girl who is like perceiving that she needs to change something about herself. This isn't so much like, you know, your specialty or your work, but you do work in rejuvenation. And like, what is happening psychologically to young girls right now?
Well, this is, I think, on sort of a large scale, the perception drift or the boiled frog idea. And back to, you know, changing the perceptions of beauty and the influencers, whoever we want to sort of point to, or however we want to point to, a very, honestly, a very multifactorial situation is, when we really think to it, we should, you know, think of like a 19 or 23-year-old who is natural. That should be, you know, by some definitions, our perceptions of the peak of beauty, right? And even that matches up with fertility a lot of times too, right? That's when those things are peaking and coming in. That's when we should be the most attractive, or the peaks of beauty. And now there's a lot of definitions and a lot of things that would change that, because that's not necessarily exactly true. But to get to the point of your question is, at what point did a unnatural, by definition, somebody who's transformed or altered something, unnatural 20-something year old become the standard of beauty? And that's that slow evolution of that perception drift over time, because now the 17, 19, 21 year olds, they're changing to meet this, and it's just perpetuating itself. I think that you could see that with something I don't do, but like breast implants historically, right? That became a new standard of beauty in an area that was by definition transformed or altered. And you could see that sort of all things gravitating towards that mean or that norm, whether you were in your teens and 20s or whether you were in your 50s, everybody was kind of going for that median area. And it's starting to happen in our faces as well. And there's just easy access to it, you know, fillers that you mentioned, or Botox, whatever these things are. It's like right around here where I'm sitting, there's 15 places within a mile that you can go get that done. At varying levels of skill and discernment, right?
Right. Is that like the med spas? Is that what they are?
It varies from state to state, even on what the laws are about who can do them. But yes.
Can you just like get a certificate to do that to someone without being a doctor? Like, have no idea.
Absolutely. Yeah. Again, state to state, whether nurses can inject or aestheticians can inject. It's not just doctors. It's all levels spanning, even where I'm sitting on sort of a state line, and in one state next to me, an aesthetician can do filler injections. And that's after, you know, the length of an aesthetician school. And on the other side, you would have to be a registered nurse or above, you know, like have a nursing degree or above. So just literally, you know, miles apart from one another. It's quite, you just know, and that is only important to illustrate that it's really hard in the pearls from the poo conversation. It's really hard to discern what you should be doing, who you should be listening to. It's very challenging from a patient standpoint. And that gets into I'm trying to, on my whole platform and world, I talk about things that I don't do. I talk about things that I do that aren't optimal, you know, for some people. I'm trying to give everybody the information to be able to discern, to critically think, and to understand like what their options are so they can take control of it themselves.
Yeah, it sounds like there's a level of informed consent that you're trying to provide people, to inspire them to think about and to engage in, because again, a lot of this, even if it's rejuvenation, is not reversible. It's kind of like once you go into this realm, you're in this realm, you know. And even like you said with the fillers, where they say it dissolves after, you know, 6 to 12 months, you know, factually, you've seen it with your own eyes. When you go in, it's not true. So there is a level of informed consent that maybe is just missing. And I think that that's true in so many areas of, you know, the maybe more conventional and even alternative space of health and wellness.
And it's interesting too. And you see those levels and, you know, again, with a really discerning eye, hopefully you can understand differences. So, you know, as patients are out seeking treatments, you know, I always challenge, this is a little thought paradigm challenge where, you know, look at before and after results and things like that. But, you know, you'd mentioned Photoshop, which hopefully isn't happening in our world too much, but I'm sure that it is. But even the types of lighting that are used. And then I think the biggest one, because lighting is everywhere and lighting can make such big differences. But I think the biggest one is when you look at a before and after, say, this is getting a little off topic, but you see things that are different. You mentioned that even when, in extreme cases, you said the word impressive earlier when you talked about the changes. And I take that to mean just like, sometimes it's like, it's shocking. Difficult to go from point A to point B. It's so different. Like that's impressively different. Yes. If you paint your house pink, that's impressively different. Wow, you painted your house pink. But that doesn't mean it's better, right? Yeah. So I always like to challenge people to say, it's different, but is it better? Is it what you would want? You know, and this gets into the 20-something year old getting lip fillers. Is that actually what you want your lips to look like all 24 hours a day walking around? You're seeing a picture of this, but then it has to go on your whole face and you have to talk and communicate and live with it for the next presumably decade. Is that what you want to do? So there's just a lot of, it's challenging. It's just really challenging.
Right. I guess impressive really wasn't the best word. It was just more like striking.
Yep, I understand.
You know, and so for me, because of the amount of retouching that I did, I was a manager at a photo studio and I was a head retoucher for many years. And the photographs would come in, right, of women doing different types of photography for their weddings or for headshots that they were getting ready to do for a job or whatever it was. And I would retouch. And there was a certain level where I'd have to say, if I do more of this, it won't look like you anymore. Because, you know, can you enhance my lips? I mean, you can do pretty much anything in Photoshop. And like now with AI, there's so much that's possible. And I remember saying, like, this won't look like you, and I have to tell you. And like, I would trim off, you know, parts of the torso, and I would reshape thighs, and I would reshape breasts, and I would actually even go sometimes into the hands to make them look, you know, 15 years younger.
Wow.
Yeah. And so, you know, I remember doing this over and over again, and sometimes like we would click the, you know, on and off, and I'd show the other retouchers in the space and they'd say, whoa, really good job. Like, that's impressive. Like, and I'm like, yep, it's impressive because it doesn't look like this person anymore. But right, now I understand, like, in this world, what's impressive to me are actually the subtle shifts of radiance that come out through really, you know, technical, thoughtful work and the holistic approach to that rejuvenation. I mean, that's actually what's impressive. And to see it last over time, that's actually what's impressive. But yeah, maybe the more appropriate word is shocking.
Well, and it's interesting that you mentioned that, because my goals with my before and afters, which I carry a pretty significant obsession with my results, I think I can safely say that, because I want you and I to have the best, you know, sort of outcome that we can have together in that forever enmeshed situation that we're in. But I want those before and afters to be, when anybody looks at them, to be better. You look at it and you're like, that's really it looks so much better, but I have no idea what happened there. Like, I don't even know what that is, right? And to get to that point, this is what when people go overseas and they have these really dramatic transformations, is you can do so much, but it's sort of what should you do? What are the right little levers to pull to make these impactful things happen without then having this transformational outcome at the end? And that's why I really dig into the neuroanatomy of beauty and what our perceptions of that look like, how we perceive faces, how we perceive emotion. And that's why a lot of these impacts come in things around the eyes often, because those are the little baby levers we can pull that carry so much weight when we do it.
So something that I've done a lot of work around in the postpartum space is with C-section scar tissue. And so when I was thinking about our conversation, I wanted to understand more how the fascia is impacted by this rejuvenation work that you do. I know that you have very specific techniques that, you know, are more maybe profound, right? You don't really work so much with the skin. You refer to it often as a rubber band. You don't want to work with that as much. You want to work with something a little bit deeper to lift it. Does this impact the fascia, and what happens with the scar tissue? And do you do work to support the healing of the scar tissue after?
The treatment of fascia starts before any treatment's done, you know, leading into it, getting things prepared. I think of myself as an athlete in preparation, execution, and recovery. And I do the same thing for my patients. I treat them like athletes. You know, we were talking offline about, you know, if we knew a day that a professional athlete was going to have an injury or a surgery, like this is the day it's happening, they're going to have a lot of prep leading into that metabolically, from an inflammation and oxidation standpoint. We want all of those things optimized. That makes the procedure go better, makes the recovery faster. And in the end, it makes our results better. And fascia is part of that. And there's nutritional supplementation, even like psychosocial aspects to how we get prepared for that. But when we get into the fascial part of things, and you mentioned, I mean, you kind of dissected that brilliantly, in that when I'm looking at skin and fat pads, I'm looking at those more qualitatively. Like, what are the qualitative approaches I can make to make those stronger, better, more robust, and more resilient? But when it comes to something like a lift, traditionally lifting, I'm just going to say like a facelift or a neck lift or something like that, those have been the targets of the facelifting and the neck lifting, is the skin and the fat pads themselves. Been that way for decades. The problem with that is those are elastic, dynamic types of tissue. And when we place tension on them, they don't handle it very well. They have issues with scarring. They have issues with stretching. It's called a tissue expander effect. You actually just make more skin, much like we can do in the pregnancy process. You know, you kind of make more skin for a period of time because of that slow onset of tension, right? But then at some point goes away. If we're focusing on fascia, it's different. Fascia is tighter, which I think somebody being pregnant for the first time mentions that. They can feel the difference in that fascia the first time it's had tension placed on it. And when we're using this in the face, directing tension to the fascia takes the burden off of those soft tissues that don't do as well with the tension. And when this is where we get into some more modern techniques, is I'm even thinking through like the embryologic development of the planes of our face, which arch it came from in embryologic development, so that I know where the important connections are, where the blood vessels and nerves are living. And I can sort of take advantage of that to find the best places to reattach and lift and move and separate things, so that I leave units that are meant to be together actually together. And this is that 80-20 Pareto principle. And this is where you can avoid issues with things like scarring, like with a C-section, right? On a C-section, you're cutting through every layer from skin to subcutaneous fat to muscle to fascia. And thicker scars there tend to be very, very, very tension dependent. We know that when tension is placed on our skin, it doesn't do as well, or it reacts to the tension by laying down a thicker scar.
Yeah, I was speaking to a Rolfer who I've known for many, many years, and she was a midwife for a long time. And she was telling me, she said, you know, I've noticed in the work that I've done with Rolfing that women's faces actually change. And a lot of, and I'd love to hear what you think about this. She's the one who kind of brought this into my awareness. She said, as we start to work on the posture, even the stance, the position of the feet, the position of the shoulders, where the tailbone is resting, we start to notice that there's actually less pull, and these like nasolabial lines actually change a little bit based on the woman's posture. And she's noticing that with all of this forward, kind of chin forward posture from being on devices and the computer and driving, that it's actually increasing the nasolabial lines, like the depth of them. Is that something you've noticed, like as far as, you know, lifestyle changes and maybe making like physical changes to prepare for this and support the rejuvenation? Is this something that you've seen, and does it make sense?
Yeah, this is another one of those wildly multifactorial issues, like, and where the rubber's meeting the road, and looking at it through the lens of a rolfer versus looking at it through the nutritional lens of the standard American inflammatory diet and how that affects it versus, you mentioned devices, right? Which gets positional. And there is undoubtedly effects with feet to face. There's no question that there's links to that. And the best examples of that get outside of the like nasolabial folds a little bit, because the muscles of facial expression that we have meant to animate are relatively small, weak muscles in comparison to structural or musculoskeletal types of muscles that move bones and joints, right? But when we get to the neck, this becomes a really important issue, because there are muscles that connect from our clavicular like outlet area to important parts of our neck that control where the positioning and angulation of our neck is. Specifically, this bone called the hyoid bone, which almost defines the angulation of our neck, and muscles that pull down on it. So say the omohyoid muscle that can pull that bone down. When we're hunched over and we're getting tight and we're pulling that down, we are quite literally making a more obtuse or blunted neck, which objectively people don't like. It makes you look older. It's not that ideal that people want with a sculpted, angulated neck. So there is unquestionably multi-skeletal or musculoskeletal impacts on how our face is aging, right? But when we talk about nasolabial folds and changes up there, we get much more into qualitative types of things than we get into necessarily positional musculoskeletal. And I'm not saying it's no impact, but you know, when I really think through it, and you know, this is full objective honesty, it's like, yeah, there's probably some of that, but there's also a million other things that would, you know, have huge impacts on them.
Yeah, it's multidimensional for sure. And I love that you even go deep into this with your patients, because it's all information. And, you know, not to get people so like hyper obsessed and hyper fixated, because I know then once you learn the new thing, all of a sudden you feel like everywhere you turn, you have to make adjustments, and it can feel really overwhelming. But I think just having that awareness that there is more to it, and a lot of it is actually within our control, right? There is just the natural unfolding that is life and time, you know, and that's something that we have to embrace and surrender into. But there are all of these things that we can do to actually support our health and our process and our radiance, you know, along with this very specific work that you do.
And I really like to emphasize and put extra effort and praise on the things that are very low consequence or low impact, right? Like rolfing, right? No question that rolfing is going to help your overall life for most people, right? It's going to improve your quality of life. So if we get this much of a facial benefit out of this thing that is overall wonderful and essentially no risk to your facial aging, that's a high praise item for me. And this comes into things like gua sha, which is essentially lymphatic massage, right? You don't need a gua sha device to do gua sha. You could do it with fingers or manual massage from somebody else. Again, some impact on your face, easy to do, no consequence. That's a high praise type of an item. Saunas, sleep, things like this, you know, when we get into this, like wildly beneficial to your cardiometabolic health, also helps your, you know, facial aging look a little bit better. Okay, great. These are wonderful things. And so I definitely slant that way more towards these things. And I think people misinterpret it when I say, you know, gua sha is a 3.8 out of 10 on the scale. Some people hear it and they're like, gua sha changed my life. It's essentially been a facelift for me. It should be a 10. And I'm like, well, I gave it a 3.8, which is pretty strong. And that involves no real work. Like it's not a zero or a negative number. And then you have other people who say gua sha does absolutely nothing. And so it's really about, I think for a lot of it, it's like, what is your lens? What are you expecting from this? And, you know, if you get a little benefit out of gua sha to your face or out of sauna to your face, but you get a wild other benefit, that's still a hard yes. You should be doing those things, you know? And so it gets really difficult to interpret when you have these anecdotal, you know, gua sha changed my life versus it did nothing. Well, how sensitive are you to those things? And in reality, this is the rule of life, right? You have the two extremes and most truths lie in the middle somewhere.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I will say personally, like when I was doing gua sha all over my body, it was really helping my lymph, but I was also dancing 5 days a week. I was cycling about 6 miles a day and I was sleeping about 9 hours every night. So that's beautiful. Actually when I looked, let's say looking like I felt the most radiant and I could see it in my face. Like there was a glow. Like I don't even think I wore blush for almost 2 years. Like it was just a natural radiance. And I was spending time in the sun. I was shielding my face, but I was getting a lot of direct sun exposure without sunscreen. And, you know, I was eating a animal-based diet and a lot of raw dairy. And I made a lot of changes and I noticed a radiance. And then I was like, you know, I noticed when I stopped doing a lot of those things because of shifts that happened in my life, that some of that radiance maybe shifted. And the cortisol actually was one of the biggest things that impacted me. When my cortisol levels went up due to, you know, construction with the home and some big changes that happened in the home space and with work and homeschooling my daughter, I noticed my face actually did change a lot. So you mentioned cortisol earlier and, yeah. You know, I have my techniques for nervous system reset and I have my practices and I have the sauna and all that, but it just, that cortisol was strong and I saw it transform my face for sure.
Yeah. I hear that a lot. You know, some of the real hard truth of that is some of the effects of like, you know, a really stressful traumatic life event with cortisol that you can't manage appropriately. You can do your best, but it's not going to be zero. That can have permanent effects on our face, or not easily reversible ones that, you know, this is where I come in a lot, honestly, is to kind of help those because now you've got cortisol managed better. You understand better. I think a lot of people just go in without the coping mechanisms in the first place to know how to do it. You don't know what you don't know. And then it happens. And then you got to figure it out and you're better prepared for next time. But that's a lot of times where I'm coming in is to, you know, okay, like let's hit the reset button. Let's rejuvenate a little bit. And then now you've got better tools moving forward from here.
Yeah. You have better tools moving forward. And so would you say, I mean, have you noticed that with your patients that certain levels of exercise and kind of the offloading and disburdening of toxins plays a huge role in that radiance?
Oh my gosh. Yeah. And you know, cause you're talking about hormetic dosing of a lot of stressors, micro dosing or moderate dosing of exercise, sun, all of these wonderful things that you're doing that build your resilience. At some level, they start to break it down. I see that in the sauna with myself all the time. And in a wonderful, oh, I pushed it too much today. I actually overdid the sauna a little bit or whatever it may be, or exercise. But yes, those, I mean, this gets into the metabolic and physiologic and emotional optimization that go into just, you know, kind of that energy, that radiance, that what you're putting out. Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah. And I know you have a lot of resources on your site and on your platform and social media. I've learned so much from you just, you know, in engaging in your content. So I really feel like this is kind of like the new wave for a lot of women to take that self-responsibility, look at this as a whole picture approach rather than these kind of isolated things to try to remedy or reverse, that it's like there's so much that can be done in their process, you know, like you said, these small things that don't have any consequence or risk, like, why not try them? You know, if there is some benefit to them, try them and maybe they'll actually enhance other areas of your life that have beautiful side effects to them, you know, like that nervous system regulation. You know, chiropractic care is really beneficial for a lot of people because it actually helps them down-regulate, which then impacts other areas of their life, which then lowers cortisol. So, you know, it's all connected. And I just love the approach that you take.
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate that. And, you know, it's interesting because as you mentioned all those things, it's like, this is when I see patients and I'm consulting with them, you know, a lot of times they have these things pretty dialed. They're pretty good at them. And so we're just kind of refining and nuancing those. And, you know, it's interesting because you know, we mentioned cortisol, and there's also, and when I say cortisol has these changes that can't be easily reversed, that exists with other things as well. Even just like sex hormone shifts as we, you know, and it happens in men and women, women especially well known around menopause, right? These are things that almost the hard part is no matter what you're doing metabolically and physically, these changes happen and they have an effect. And this is where a lot of those mismatches start to come, big stressful events, times around menopause. And so that's where you can really focus on, you know, the things you've talked about to optimize, but that's where people are often seeking help too, and an actual regeneration for those things.
Why are women taking the fat out of their faces now? Like the Bucol reductions? You just explain? Cause I think there's so many like, beautiful, radiant women, and then they remove that. Is that like just because it's a trend? Is that reversible later? Like, can you put the fat back? Like,
yeah, I was just talking about this with one of my fellows yesterday. So the buccal fat is a very unique fat pad when we think of our facial structure. It's the deepest when we think three-dimensionally. It's the deepest. It's actually accessed through the inside of the mouth. It's so deep. It is an important, like, structural peg in our face for everything to sit on. And over time, like all fat pads do, and I use analogies of like facial fat pads or breasts or whatever it is, the fat changes its shape, volume, distribution, shape. And the buccal fat pad does that too. It sinks down and tends to kind of accumulate at the bottom of its structure. That doesn't mean there's more of it or too much of it. Usually it actually shrinks, but it just conglomerates down in this area around the corner of the mouth. And so people think, I'm going to take that buccal fat pad out. It definitely is driven by fads and trends. And there's a small subset of the population, often ethnically linked to certain facial types, where it gets really full in the lower portion and the buccal fat plays a role. And if that person wants to thin their face out, they can actually tolerate a little bit of buccal fat reduction without prematurely aging them. The problem is when you're just, I'm going to just make this up, when you're 51 or 53 and you've noticed this fullness here and someone comes and takes your buccal fat out, you maybe have taken care of this one little fullness here, but now you've created a whole mess of aging problems in the rest of the face. It's a downstream domino effect. That would be a prime example of my mindset shift. I, as far as I know, I'm the only person in the world who takes that buccal fat pad, accesses it in the same way, but instead of cutting it out, I replace it. I lift it back up. I put it back where it came from. And like I said a long time ago, if I could nutshell my entire surgical world that's just putting things back where they came from, the buccal fat pad is like the best example of that for me, because I'm the only person who does it. And I've been developing this technique of, well, how can I, instead of cutting it out, how can I just put it back? And anyway, that's a prime example of just, you know, all the things we talked about, perceptions of beauty, trends, what's driving procedures, mindsets, and ways to rejuvenate it. Just put it back.
Beautiful. Yeah. I mean, it's my friend who sent me your work. She said, you know, one of the things I love is that there's a lot of, I don't want to say like, I mean, I'm no judge of that, but like bad work out there. And sometimes things that could have been done a little differently. And you have this grace in your approach and this, like this kind of detail and elegance to fixing it in a subtle way that can make it palatable and more enjoyable for the recipient, you know, for the patient. So can you just give one example before we wrap up of one, like maybe like someone who's come to you with kind of like they were dealt a bad hand with the procedure and you supported the process for them to actually feel good again in their body?
Man, that's a great question. I have, I can think of a lot of examples of that ranging through, you know, people who came in. I do a lot of revision work, a lot of fixing work that was done prior that just needs help. Sometimes it's disastrous, botched, people say. Sometimes it's just not great. And sometimes it's part of a process that we're working through. But, you know, I think when I think of like your audience and what, you know, people might resonate with in there, a lot of times I'm seeing somebody who it has kind of gone through this filler phase. And, you know, I have had this over and over again, but a few particular patients come to mind where they've got on the perception drift. They get into this time point where, you know, they have had kids and they're growing up and they are starting to look back at this time frame that is like, well, I've been getting filler now for 10 years, you know, fill in the blank number of years, and I don't feel like myself anymore. I don't look like myself anymore. It's arguably aged that person even more than they would have looked like without it. And they are in a difficult spot because they don't like where they're currently at. They recognize that they're distorted and it's not true to them, but they also feel like they're too young to do something, to kind of take it to a different level. And this is my niche. This is where I live. This is the world I'm in where, okay, how can we simultaneously undo in a very respectful and minor way, undo what the filler is doing? Because it's not all bad, but how can we take that to a natural place and at the same time rejuvenate these little areas that are bothering you, kind of maybe the reason you got the filler in the first place? What can we do that's actually durable for that? And this is it's a very common space for me. And in the end, it's this wonderful ability to look back at those older pictures and sort of like morph things back in that direction in a durable way that then stays there. And yeah, this is my every week type of situation. And I love it. Those are wonderful relationships and wonderful outcomes. And you can see a lot of those on my social media. Sometimes they're more extreme. Sometimes they're very subtle like that. More extreme meaning the person's in trouble. But other times it's just these little subtle, like, I have some cognitive dissonance. I don't like where I'm at. I kind of know why I got here now. And how do I get on a new path forward where I just don't really have to do much? And great, let's do it.
Yeah, that's beautiful. It's like there's a maturation process that seems like it's happening at the same time, you know, in an evolution. Absolutely. Within their own journey. So, absolutely. Wow. Thank you so much. This has been incredibly illuminating for me. And I could talk to you for hours. There's just such a wealth of knowledge here. And I love the approach that you have, this like 360 approach to this whole experience and an acknowledgement of the psycho-emotional, of the energetic. And I think that is something that really can help a lot of women heal and move through this process, you know, with more grace and ease.
Thank you. I love learning from you and from my patients, because again, you're not going to hear a lot of plastic surgeons talk about energy. It's almost frowned upon. It's very hand wavy. And I believe in it and I feel it. And I love my emotional maturation in that, actually, and picking that up from people. So still in development.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Dr. Chestnut.
Yeah, well, thank you for having me, and I really appreciate it.